This is Professor Ellen Norey. I'm interviewing Professor Larry McEnany from the Department of Physics. It's November 4th, 2005. This is Ellen Norey, and I'm interviewing Professor Larry McEnany. It's Friday, November 4th, 2005, 9 o'clock in the morning. So, I just wrote down a few questions here. Normally, I send them to people ahead of time, but I just opened my email yesterday from you. So.
Okay.
And so I asked just, how did you come to be a physicist? And
well, I was a Navy V-12 student in electrical engineering. I joined the Navy right out of high school, immediately.
And what year was that?
1943.
Okay.
I graduated from high school in June, and the Navy sent me to the University of Kansas, where I arrived on July 1st, 1943, and I was in an electrical engineering program. And so I had 8 semesters, bing, 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 one after another. And so at the age of 19, I graduated in electrical engineering and was commissioned ensign and shipped off to sea to recuperate from all this.
To sea where?
Well, across the Pacific.
In the
I had
Pacific?
2 trips across the Pacific,
okay,
with the Navy. And I had decided along about my what would have been my senior year in electrical engineering, that I really didn't want to be an engineer. What decided me was a thermodynamics book with all the formulas on page 8, and it was then application of those formulas, and I found that I was much more interested in how those formulas came to be than in applying them to engines and so forth. And my physics courses, I took an extra physics course or two as an elective, what they used to call atomic physics in those days. I found that much more interesting. And so I had decided that I didn't want to work as an engineer. I wanted to switch to physics, so I did. Ship came into San Francisco, and so I went over to Berkeley, and all I really wanted to do was pick up the undergraduate courses in physics, and I had no idea. I wasn't very sophisticated. I had no idea of doing graduate work. And so I went up and talked to them, they said, what's the point in getting another, you might as well work for a graduate degree. So I said, okay, I guess I could. And that was about my first thought of doing that.
And this was in 1945?
This was 1945.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
My Navy career was certainly interesting. I got to Nagasaki in June of 1945, toward the devastated area, which was an industrial area primarily, in Nagasaki. The town of Nagasaki wasn't as bad a shape as Manila, for example. But anyway, I went to Berkeley. There were all these famous physicists, of course, J. Robert Oppenheimer,
yes,
had come back, and the first so-called Department T I went to, I understood nothing but the articles and prepositions in the talk. J. Robert Oppenheimer was talking about the state of nuclear physics, and there were at least five Nobel Prize winners sitting there in the front row. And I was impressed and humbled. And but I learned that the way one did a PhD at Berkeley was to become a member of the team of some great man, and you had this project, and if you worked faithfully, which often meant day and night, literally, you were sublet a portion of the project to write up as your thesis, and I decided that wasn't what I was interested in, and so I got my master's and went back to the University of Kansas, where I could do a less spectacular, but my own project. So that was my story in physics. And so by that time I was married and had one child, was about to have another, and I taught it after I finished my exams, but had not finished the thesis. I went to work at, because of family concerns, I guess, I went to work at teaching at Park College, Parkville, Missouri, small Presbyterian liberal arts college. I think I got a reasonable liberal arts education there, mm-hmm. teaching there, and finally finished up my PhD in 1957, and the person who had been registrar at Park College had been looking for another position, and he somehow, John Schnabel.
Yes.
He got onto SIU, and he knew they needed somebody in physics, and realized that Park College was not paying hardly anything. and that I might be interested. So I came out for an interview, and that's how I got to SIU.
And this was in September?
It was in the summer of 1957.
Okay.
And so I really started a little bit early. August, actually, of 57. And I had some thanks for prepare. It was interesting, of course, because I should mention that George Arnold, mm-hmm. who you probably know, was part of the Carbondale physics faculty, and he came up when SIU took over the Shirtliff campus and taught a physics course in the summer of 1957. So he was really the first physics person, although he was officially Carbondale. And at any rate, I started in August and preparing as well as I could for some laboratory experiments and a general course and all. And
what kind of equipment did you have at Shirtliff? Compared to what you had seen, at Berkeley and at Kansas.
Yeah. We had a fantastic collection of junk. Okay. A lot of it was military surplus, which the Shirtliff physics prof, who I never met, but he must have been quite a character from what I've heard. Shirtliff was a Baptist school, and he decorated the walls of the area with Playboy pictures and things like that. And these Baptist ministers would come around and be horrified. But in terms of equipment, he had a lot of military surplus and some very basic physics equipment, galvanometers and so forth. And so I spent my time devising experiments which could make use of what we had. The budget was pretty small, but it did enable us to get a few essentials. So that was pretty much it. And then we did have some physics majors left over from Sherlock. Mm-hmm. And in addition to the general physics course, I taught an electricity and magnetism senior course that year. And Eric Sterley, who had been hired to teach math, but couldn't arrive until the second quarter, until January, left a vacancy, a kind of a hole in the math program. So I also taught differential equations that first year, which was all right.
Did you use when you're just coming in? You had been teaching these courses at the liberal arts college at Parks College.
At Park College,
yeah. Okay.
You know, it was strictly undergraduate, but I'd been.
You had taught these classes.
Right.
So did you use a textbook or did you design the course from scratch?
All we had was the Carbondale catalog. So we taught the courses all from what it said in the Carbondale catalog, which of course is, like most catalog, pretty vague, so you could do about anything you wanted. But, you know, that was all right. They had a senior course in electricity and magnetism, and I taught from that and from the differential equations course, which was a junior-senior course, I guess. So that worked out pretty well. I didn't have, a tremendous problem with this is unsuitable or anything of that sort. It worked out all right.
And so you really did have enough an equipment to teach the.
Well, the undergrad, physics. The general physics lab was pretty lacking in things, and I can't remember in detail what the equipment we had. We had some fairly common fundamental stuff, but I remember particularly that the lab had a number of wall galvanometers. I don't know whether you know what I mean by that, but they were it's a basic current detecting device. It has a little magnet and a coil around it, which when you put a current, a tiny current, which was all it would take, through the coil would turn in the magnetic field, and had a mirror attached and shine a light on the mirror, and then there was a big scale, and you looked through a telescope and saw where the light was on the scale, and that was the galvanometer reading. But it was, I guess you'd call it an electromechanical device, because it had this fiber which provided basically a spring mechanism and from which the coil was suspended. And so I could do mechanical experiments with the galvanometer. Mm-hmm. I remember, so I devised a number of experiments using those wall galvanometers that that were only partially electrical. The mechanical properties, the time of oscillations, the period of oscillations was, you know, something we could measure. We had stopwatches and so on. And so it was a lot of improvisation that first year.
Well, I wonder, as a physicist in the 1950s, did you feel as though you were kind of on the crest of the future? I asked, how did you feel as a young person?
Yeah, there was a shortage at that time, which worked out well for me. I probably wouldn't have been hired if there hadn't been.
I noticed
my thesis was on superconductivity, and a theoretical thesis, and so there wasn't much opportunity to do much with that. I had a friend from grad school at Kansas who was with the Von Braun group at Huntsville, Marshall Space Flight Center. And so vacation periods, I went down and as a consultant with NASA at Huntsville. That was also very interesting. They were, you know, I got to be in the bunker when they were testing the rocket engines and things like that for the Saturn project. I had cotton in my ears, but man, those engines were loud. And so it was interesting.
I noticed that you spoke in 1958 to the Alton Kiwanis about Sputnik. You probably don't remember.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, I did. I learned a lot about the history of the space program. It had not much to do with SIU, but you know, we had the International Geophysical Year, I think it was called,
yes,
when we were supposed to launch a satellite, which was 1957. And the Von Braun group was at Huntsville, and the powers that be in Washington did not want the German group to be the first ones to launch a satellite, even though the Von Braun group, they had basically the old V-2 rockets, and they could have launched a satellite very readily. They had them. But the order was given to the Navy, who didn't have anything, to launch the first satellite. And the Von Braun group, you know, I learned this because I was with my friend, and the Von Braun group was forbidden to do anything relating to a satellite.
Oh, I see.
And but they did. They bootlegged it. In fact, they showed me where they, when the people from Washington came around, they showed me where they hid the satellite that they were building. And the Navy Vanguard project, it was. I don't know whether you remember any of that or not, but the Vanguards all blew up. They tried to, they had grapefruit size by what, October? Or September, October, I don't remember which. Sputnik 1 went up. And the Vanguards had done nothing but explode. And they had a grapefruit size satellite which they had planned to launch, the Navy. This hurts because I was somewhat partial to the Navy. But the Vanguards blew up. They never launched anything. And Sputnik went up. And so the United States was somewhat embarrassed. And they finally gave the order to the Von Braun group. To go ahead with the satellite. And of course, they accomplished it remarkably soon, mm-hmm. since they had it hidden. And so they, in January of 58, they launched Explorer 1, I think it was called. So, and there were some interesting stories about that too. It was an elongated satellite, and they gave it some spin. And they were thinking, like a rifle bullet, that since it was spinning, it would go around the Earth in this fashion, always pointing in the same direction in mm-hmm. space. And you know how a rifle bullet, because yes. it's spinning,
yes.
it conserves the angular momentum, and it just goes around. So they found, much to their surprise, that it began to wobble, and very soon went into a flat spin as it went around the Earth. And this surprised all these high-powered people, German engineers and all these folks, they were surprised by this. And they sat down, they realized that using a little sophomore physics, for a given angular momentum, which they gave uh-huh. it when they launched it, the lowest energy state is the flat spin. Mm-hmm. So as it flexed and so forth, it would lose energy. Flexing would cause heat, and the heat would dissipate. Mm-hmm. So it lost energy and went from a higher energy state, which is what it started, to the lowest energy state for that angular momentum, sophomore physics, which was the flat spin. So there were some funny stories.
Yes.
The hiding it. And they also found with Explorer 1 that they had these reporting stations downrange in Spain and Canary Islands or someplace and so forth. And they launched it, and my friend was part of the group that was supposed to calculate the orbit. And so they waited for the report to come in, and the time came for it to come in. Didn't come in. And they began to say, oh, okay, who's going to go tell the generals that this thing flopped in the ocean and didn't go into orbit because the report didn't come in. Finally, it came in. Came in late. And so they could go ahead and calculate. They didn't have to tell the generals that it flopped. And
these are great stories.
Yeah, I thought it was. And it turned out that everybody who had anything to do with launching the rocket did not want their particular function to cause failure. So they put a little more into it than they were required and said they did. So the thing is, it had more energy. It went into a higher orbit than they expected, uh-huh. and that was why the report came in late. But I think kind of funny stories.
Yes, because people think of scientists and those kinds of activities particularly as cut and dried.
Oh, yeah.
And everything predictable.
It's supposed to work every day.
Yes.
Exactly.
As yes.
It isn't that way. Okay. they're just people. And
well, we could.
The German engineers were a bit of a problem.
Were they people who had been picked up on Operation Paperclip?
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. But the German engineers. Anyway, one of the assignments I had down there was to study this flat spin. And once they learned that the flat spin was the normal state for an elongated satellite, for a spherical one, it wouldn't make any difference, but for an elongated one, flat spin was normal. They decided that they would make it go into the flat spin faster and dissipate energy by putting a partially filled with mercury torus in the thing. donut with partially filled with mercury that would slosh. The sloshing would dissipate energy, and it would go into the flat spin faster. And all the instrumentation, such as it was in those days, was designed for the flat spin. So Explorer 11 had this donut, and it took a month to go into the flat spin, whereas Explorer 1 went in right away. And one of the things I was supposed to do was figure out why it didn't. And the mechanics of the donut was such that it didn't slosh. And
did you figure it out?
Yeah, I figured out that's why it didn't go in. But the German engineers didn't agree with that. They said it was because there was a tape recorder run by battery in there, and every time some energy went out, the tape recorder battery put the energy back in. Well, it was easy, again, sophomore physics, to know that it could only put in a small fraction of the energy that was lost. So it was the non-sloshing effect in the donut that caused them. Anyway, it was fun. It was, the German engineers were good at rockets. Their general physics wasn't any better than
so
people.
It sounds like you...
But they were hard to get along with.
You lived in two worlds. You had a world where you jumped in and did the science with these people, and then you had a world here where you were a teacher and a faculty leader.
Well, I'm probably exaggerating what I did in Huntsville. Mainly it was these stories are what were told me. Because Explorer 1 was already up there, and this, you know, this was past history that I learned by being there. So, but I had no role in.
But you did work on Explorer 11.
Yes. Uh-huh. Yeah. I did it particularly.
And when was Explorer 11 launched? Was that 1959 or 60? I don't know. I don't know
either. I don't have a very good time.
That's okay.
I have a terrible built-in timeline, so.
Well, I was going to ask you about your experience at SIUE and anything you want to say. I said your overview of it.
Okay. Well, I came, and I decided that I was really much more interested in teaching and the academic side of it than I was in research, and I knew it would, by taking this job, it would not be the greatest research opportunity in the world. But particularly since I was, you know, one person. And but the opportunity to build a program from scratch I appealed to me. And so that was important. The head of the Alton Resident Center was a man named Eric Baber.
Yes.
He, like Harold C., came from public education, and which I had no experience with. But I remember the first faculty meeting, he handed out some papers, and then he read them to us. And I was sitting there squirming and thinking, oh my God, I've made a terrible mistake. I can read. I don't need to be read to. And that was kind of a low point. And SIU hired anyone from Shirtliff who had a PhD. They hired, and most of them were fine. They hired a few who didn't, but they had, if the person had a PhD, they hired him. And I remember they got some really bum ones. I heard somebody teaching spelling down the hall from me. You know, I'd sit in my office and, how is this person teaching spelling? Why is he? I thought it must be an education class, you know, teaching grade school teachers how to teach people to spell. And I finally saw one of my physics students coming out of that class and asking, "What, you know, what's going on? What kind of a class is this?" And he says, "It's psychology." And, "Well, what's the deal with the spelling?" "Oh, he likes spelling. And it isn't enough if you have a two-syllable word. You had to pause between, so like, spell Concord. If you said C-O-N-C-O-R-D, no good. It was C-O-N, pause, C-O-R-D. And I thought, holy Moses, this is psychology? I remember I went up to see Baber. I says, "You know, what's going on here with this? This doesn't sound like psychology to me." And this person didn't stay around long, who was doing that. I hated to blow the whistle on somebody, but I figured if this school's going to mount anything, they've got to. Anyway, that was... So those were some of the negative, early experiences. And then of course, being one of the new hired faculty members, and this being a new institution, I immediately was on all sorts of committees. And the basic, Delight Morris formed a big committee for the, you know, the future of the campus and so on. And some of the faculty who had come from more conventional situations were thinking in terms of a conventional situation. And Delight Morris was not. And I like that. He, I very quickly realized that most of the universities in the United States had been liberal arts colleges. Mm-hmm. And then, particularly after the Civil War, they found it appropriate to introduce professional schools. And so the mold of a university was a College of Arts and Sciences as a center, and then a few professional schools established around it. And that's what I had always experienced too. Morris saw no reason why the historical model should be the appropriate one. And so he had this divisional structure. And that, frankly, that seemed very logical to me. And I was, I guess, one of the few who was upset when, under Earl Lazarson, we went to the conventional model. And I thought, I thought some of the reasons were silly to go to the conventional model. I think one of the big ones was that, but by this time I was dean of sciences and so on, so I was acquainted with the deans and so on. I thought one of the big problems was when they had a meeting of the deans of colleges of arts and sciences, they didn't know who should go. Should it be the social science dean? Should it be the humanities dean? Should it be the fine arts dean? I thought, I didn't agree with Morris on a lot of things, but I thought his mm-hmm. model was made sense. I still think so, but I'm obviously...
Any other reasons you think it makes sense?
You had a dean who was directly concerned with a small number of people. He had chairpersons, but the number reporting to the dean was very relatively small. Mm-hmm. And the dean had some professional interest in all those subjects. Whereas when you have a dean of liberal arts, you have, I don't know, how many dozen people reporting to him, which is not a good management mm-hmm. scheme. That's one thing. And so I thought it was a good idea. Also, and you know, I lost on this one too. I thought it made sense to have the pure or academic and applied segments of a subject kept closely related, like sociology and social work, for example, or physics and math and engineering. Keeping these in relatively close contact with one another.
And this
could happen in the divisional scheme. So I mm-hmm. thought it was a good one.
How did you feel about the split of science and engineering in 83?
Well,
splitting of the creation of a school of engineering and a
yeah,
school of science.
Yeah. Well, again, I thought that it would have been better to keep engineering and sciences together, but the engineering accreditation associations didn't think so.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had sort of mixed feelings. I had a rather major stake in getting engineering established here. That's probably the biggest story I have, my connection with SIU. I became, an assistant dean of academic affairs under Bill Going in 63, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
And then by 1966, with McVicker in charge of the academic program, I became dean of this school. I think mm-hmm. when I was appointed, it was still division, but it soon became School of Science and Technology.
Mm-hmm.
But technology was forbidden, engineering was forbidden. The State Board of Higher Education was pretty well controlled by University of Illinois people.
Mm-hmm.
And the University of Illinois opposed other state engineering schools being allowed to exist because the other state institutions were had been in the previous recent history
mm-hmm.
School education,
yes,
teaching schools, whatever you call them. And the U of I engineering people, science people, did not want to see engineering schools with teachers' college standards,
mm-hmm.
which were really lower. And it was the University of Illinois and the Seven Dwarfs. So there was a great deal of opposition to on the part of the State Board of Higher Education to allowing engineering schools to develop. And in fact, you know, again, I can't give the timeline properly, but probably I became dean of sciences in 66, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And it was not more than a year after that, I guess, 67 or 60. They started removing from the SIUE budget the amount of money that they figured we spent on applied science, which is what we called our budding engineering program, to discourage us from doing that. And so I remember many conversations with the higher board staff about how engineering wasn't as expensive as it used to be, and that the SIUE had never been a teacher's college, did not have teacher's college standards. Traditional model, well, my engineering at the University of Kansas, for example, we had a hydraulics lab in which we had great big pumps and pipes and a pool that the water would go into and all this stuff, you know. And in electrical engineering labs, we had monstrous motor generator sets and which we ran, and synchronous motors and induction motors and all sorts of big stuff. And I figured a modern engineering program would not have any of that monster stuff, that everything miniaturization was be. I didn't think of this by myself. Miniaturization in science and engineering was well underway, and was certainly the trend. And I tried to convince them, you're thinking of engineering at the U of I and Northwestern and places like Kansas where I went. And we're not talking about engineering like that. They still didn't want to do it. So it was the efforts of the faculty, the students, the Board of Trustees, John Rendleman, when I went over, when I found they were taking this money out of our budget, you know, I went over to see John Rendleman, hey, look what they're doing this, what are we going to do? And he said, we're going to keep on. So that's what we did. So the credit really goes to all those people. I felt I was in the middle of the fight, mm-hmm. but it was the support of everybody, from Rendleman to the students to the faculty to the Board of Trustees, that really won the battle. And so when the IBHE staff finally became cognizant of all of this, they said, I remember them saying, okay, if you can get accredited in engineering, we'll okay the program. We got our engineering people arranging to have the accreditation team come in. Happily, we got the maximum accreditation they could give was 6 years. And that very first time, we got a 6-year accreditation. And that was the only good thing I remember about being dean. Being dean. When I was appointed dean in 56, I thought, oh, that's a great honor. I feel good about that. Wonderful. I'm a dean. I'm a slow learner. It took me about 6 weeks to discover that being a dean is a rotten job. I mean, instead of doing what you want to do, you're messing with budgets and hearing complaints and every faculty felt that all the others were being favored instead of theirs. I thought, holy moly, what have I gotten into here? Being dean is no fun at all. The only thing that was fun was the battle for engineering. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Accreditation came. I know I have a note on this. It was 69?
That sounds right. Again,
I'm not sure either without...
If you can get a note from engineer, they'd probably know.
No, I've got it written down somewhere. Uh-huh. I've sort of followed this.
Oh, but, okay. Yeah, I think that sounds right.
Okay.
And so, anyway, being dean, wearing a necktie, all that was not my idea. How I wanted to spend my life. And
so, how long were you dean?
I was dean of sciences and technology for 6 years. I stuck it out for 6 years, but I was very glad to go back to straight teaching after that. And Earl Lazarson was Earl was amazing. I had made Earl mathematics chairman, and I thought he should be dean, and the faculty agreed with me. So when my 6 years was up, I was Earl was my recommendation, and he did a good job. Of course, he didn't stay in it long. He became provost and then president. He was a very efficient person. The only thing I thought that was really terrible was appointing, what's her name, is provost.
I now know her name. I didn't know, yeah. I never knew her, but her name is Barbara Teeters.
Yeah, Barbara Teeters. He appointed Barbara Teeters. And I went on sabbatical and came back and learned about the things that she'd, been doing. So I went over. I'd had a very close relationship with Earl. I mean, Friday afternoons when he was chairman of math, and he and I and a couple of others would usually go over and have a drink or something. And there was a place over the other side of on 159 in Edwardsville. I can't remember the name of it, but we'd go over and have a drink or two. But I went to see him to ask him what the hell he was doing appointing Barbara Teeters as provost. And he would hardly listen to me.
I think for the historian, that's the question. Was her appointment a mistake? Because she had gone to Michigan. I could see reasons why she would stand out in the pile to him.
I guess.
And then Japanese studies, and then Spanish. He'd been to China.
Yeah.
And I could see that as he getting swept away. Or did he see her limitations but decide that he would hire her to do what he had to do? I don't know. I
mean, to take the heat.
To take the heat.
That was
because
generally the faculty opinion and mine too.
Uh-huh.
Because she took a lot of heat. And, it was unbelievable. I thought I was the most inefficient person with paperwork in the world. But she was maybe worse than I. Judgment.
This is where I am in the boxes.
Oh, okay.
In my pursuit through the files.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, anyway, that was a different story.
I saw her evaluations from 83.
Uh-huh.
They're in the file. They're kind of hidden in the files, where you wouldn't expect to look for them.
Really?
Yes, but they're a huge, very poor, almost in every category.
Uh-huh.
And this is quite soon after she was hired, either 82 or 83.
Well, it became obvious that a couple of things. She didn't run things the way they'd been run. When I was a dean, John Rendleman was president. There was something called a dean's conference, which included all the deans and John Abbott, the librarian, and so forth. And we met every week, once a week, and we discussed university affairs, what was going on with the university, what the priorities were, and what the problems were, and so forth. So when I said engineering was the only good thing about Dean Dean, I guess I was wrong, because the other thing that was good was the Dean's Conference, where the deans had a stake in the entire university and what it was doing. And I found that a pleasant operation. So that all changed.
Yes.
By the time I was no longer dean, the deans didn't have that role anymore. It was strictly a proprietary function. It was, heck with the rest of the university. My organization needs this and this and this. That certainly Teeters did not seek any advice from on the university on what she should do as provost from the other deans. And as far as I could tell, I was no longer in the loop then. But she was very inefficient. Things wouldn't get done. And her judgment was not in line, I thought, with academic expectations. So I was disappointed with Earl in that respect. He is, I guess. I haven't seen him for a long time, but he's an extremely bright guy and very capable. And I remember being very pleased when he became president. But with the Teeters, I was sort of, just went down.
I haven't come to when she is, she was VPNP for quite a long time.
Yes, quite a while.
I haven't come to the end yet.
No. I was pretty much out of the loop by that time. I was just another voice in the crying in the wilderness at that time.
Well, going back to John Rendleman.
Yeah.
Did you know him? I mean, did.
Yeah, I.
Did you know him before he became?
I met him at some banquet. In those early years, there was quite a bit more interaction with Carbondale. And I remember I sat next to him at some banquet. That was the first time I met him in Carbondale, before he was up here at all. He was legal counsel to the university at that time. And I remember talking to him. And I had heard that he had great political stature and southern Illinois and so on. Somewhat impressed him. And those, going back a little bit to the early years, I don't suppose you, well, I suppose you do have pretty much a story on Harold C.
Well, I don't know what the story is. I'd like to hear your version of it.
Oh, okay. So we're going back here a little bit.
That's fine.
Okay, well, of course, when I was hired, Harold C. was the big shot, and he was, his office was in the Broadview Hotel, and he was one of the persons I interviewed for the job, and that interviewed me, I should say. Get my syntax. He was a pretty impressive guy. He, again, struck me as being very efficient. He knew what he was about, and I felt good about him being in charge. In contrast to Baber, who was read to us, among other things. And, and there was a lot of... we had some good people. That were hired initially. People like Bill Gulling, mm-hmm. who I think is one of the greatest people ever associated with this university. And there was a lot of talk about how we didn't really expect to have much in common with Carbondale. We were in a very different setting, and there was a lot of faculty talk about what this should be called, and should we have a different board of trustees, and so on. There were people with influence who would come around. Our names escape me a lot. The senator, the bow tie.
Oh, Paul Simon.
Paul Simon visited SIU very mm-hmm. often in those early days, and he had the newspaper, and he was in the state legislature when we started. So a lot of us had expectations that we would be independent, and Harold C. Participated in this to a greater extent than he should have. At least I had that impression. He didn't knock it down at any rate.
Mm-hmm.
And when Dwight Morris became fully aware of this, then all of a sudden Harold C. went to work, and his key didn't fit the office door anymore,
mm-hmm.
and he was bounced. He didn't kowtow to the one man who was his boss, and so nobody. Dwight Morris was very much a tyrant. He was smart. He had a lot of good ideas. And he did some things very, very well,
mm-hmm.
particularly deal with the state politicians and so on. I'm sure you know much the story about Dwight, how he had some Quonset huts on the campus at Carbondale.
No, I haven't heard this.
Quonset huts down there. People were teaching. It was expanding rapidly right after the war. And he would get the state legislators down there, and he'd say, look, see, you know, we're teaching in these terrible places. We need appropriations for buildings and so on. And he'd get the appropriations, and he'd build a building, and the legislators would go down. The Quonset huts were still there. And they went, well, we're expanding so fast. We need more buildings. So he was an expert at the political process. And it took a long time to get rid of those Quonset huts, but they served the university very well. And his ideas, like I mentioned previously, he had very different ideas for this campus. all the things he thought that were wrong with Carbondale were not going to be wrong with the situation up here. And he was a communications person. He had forward-looking, I guess he would say, ideas about how teaching should be done. When we were building the first few buildings, one of them was a communications building, mm-hmm. of course, and the idea was that there would be classrooms with just a monitor in there, and the prof would be lecturing in the basement of the communications building to several classrooms in different buildings. And he had the idea that classrooms would not have permanent walls. They could change them in the 10 minutes between classes, I think he thought. The big classes, small classes, yet. More ideas about flexibility than were practical. and of course, nobody went for his teaching by television stuff. It was tried.
It was.
And the labs, when the science building was being built, his idea was that a lab would not be a physics lab or a chemistry lab or something. It would be a science lab. And one period there would be earth science in there, and another period there would be physics and chemistry. And all this would change from period to period, which was ridiculous. And you can imagine, a lab where people are smashing rocks 1 hour, and then you get in there the next with some delicate electronic apparatus, and this wouldn't work. Couldn't convince it. And
was this tried when you first moved into the science building?
The flexibility was supposed to be there. The walls were displaceable. And I would say it never really worked out that way. Another way, in building the campus, it was interesting. We met a lot with Gio Obata.
Yes.
And who was, fine, but Morrison, he would get the ideas from all the faculty and his own ideas, and he would make a statistical average with giving everybody else's idea a statistical weight of 0 and his own a statistical weight of 1. He'd take an average, and what do you know, things were built the way he wanted. The labs in the basement of the science building, of course. They wanted 2 doors, and they wanted them far apart in the lab. And everybody in science said, look, we want to, move some big equipment into some of these rooms. The doors should be at least side by side, swing open, give them one. Uh-huh. No. They were all built with small doors 20 feet apart, whatever it was. And then we started to move in the building. We had some big equipment. They had to literally tear out the door frame and so forth to get some of this stuff in. So he had some ideas that weren't so good. And when Harold C. was fired, because Harold C. did have some ideas about the relative independence of the two campuses. I think that was the main reason he found the locks changed. Three of us, Eric Sterling and I, and I can't think of the third person.
A third person from science?
No.
No.
No, it was from...
Humanities?
From humanities? I think sociology.
Okay.
I'm sure you read...
Virgil Seymour?
No, it wasn't Virgil. It was...
The guy, let's see.
The guy that was here, and then he wasn't here.
Hyman Frankel?
Yeah, Hi Frankel. Okay. Yeah, Hi Frankel. I'm terrible at forgetting.
That's all right. You're wonderful, and, really.
So anyway, we were appointed as a committee to assist the president in finding a replacement for Harold C. And this is a funny episode. So we met once with Morris in this house he has down here, by the lake. And he had arranged to have visitors, a quote-unquote candidate, who was, I think, at that time president of Pittsburgh State College in Kansas. Pittsburgh, Kansas.
Oh, I thought you were going to say University of Virginia.
No. Small college in Kansas. And so we were supposed to interview him, and we all sat around. And he wanted to know who we were, of course, and a man in physics and a man in math, particularly. And what he did was try to recruit us to go to Pittsburgh State College in Kansas to... at least Eric and I, because he was short of mathematicians and physicists. And so that didn't work out too well. And then we had a second meeting that was scheduled, and that was just with Dwight Morris. And he said, do any of you know Clarence Stevens? Clarence Stevens. And none of us had met him. So Morris went on for, 15, 20 minutes talking about what a good man Clarence Stevens was. And of course, he was right. Clarence was a very good man. But we'd never met him, and all we could do is nod and so forth. That was all that happened at that meeting. But a day or two later, I read in the paper that, I guess in the Post-Dispatch, that Clarence Stevens was hired to head the Edwardsville campus, or whatever they were calling it at that time, was hired with the assistance of a faculty committee. I remember that especially. And I got together with Eric and Hi Frankel, and we just laughed and laughed at that. It was, I guess we could have been indignant, but we thought it was hilarious. And
so you had some close contact with Dwight Morris.
Oh, yes. Yeah, he had... Well, he had these committees to, in effect, decide something, starting even before the Edwardsville site had been selected. And he'd meet with faculty and discuss with them. He listened to all our ideas. And then he went ahead and did what he wanted to do. He had his own ideas, and those, like I say, had a statistical weight much stronger than ours.
do you think he really was listening? Or was he one of these people who isn't really listening, or was he really listening?
I had every impression that he was listening.
Okay.
And he acted happy to have the input, and if he was... If he wasn't, he didn't show it. But when it came down to actually doing something, making a decision. That was, you know, sometimes we all agree with him anyway. I mean, you know, like I say, the divisional yes. setup, the idea of having a large amount of land and not having honky-tonk bars right at the edge of the campus. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he had a lot of great ideas like that. And he would talk to people. He was interested. He was very interested in what was happening in with NASA in Huntsville. Uh-huh. And he was interested, you know, he always liked boats. There's a marvelous story at Carbondale about the, which you, I don't know whether you know or not, I've ever heard.
Oh.
About the minesweeper he bought.
No.
The wooden minesweeper. Oh. You'll have to get that from somebody at Carbondale.
Okay.
I have that secondhand. It had nothing to do with Edwardsville. He bought a war surplus minesweeper. And eventually it sank.
For Crabtree Lake?
Huh?
For Crabtree Lake down there?
No. It had to come up the Mississippi River from New Orleans, I think.
Okay.
And the head of biology down there, Harvey Fisher, I think his name was.
Yes. I was going to ask you about him anyway.
Yeah. Well,
because he wrote a lot of memos. He met with your committee many times.
Yes, he did.
Uh-huh.
And he was pretty smart guy, but he'd had a lot of naval experience. So, I'd been on a ship, but I didn't run the ship. And but he did. He had so. He was assigned to bring this, he was given a big line of credit by Morris and the university to bring this minesweeper up. And just what Morris had in mind to do with it, I'm not sure. But anyway, Harvey Fisher went down to get the minesweeper with a few others. And they got it part way up, and the engine conked out, and so they had to pull in at one of the ports on the Mississippi between New Orleans and Carbondale, and they got the thing in the port, and then there was a flood or something, and the minesweeper had a wood hull, and a big log came down the river and smashed in the hull, and it sank right at the dock. But those are the basics of the story. There are a lot of Dwight Morris stories. He was quite a character. Clarence Stevens came up. He was very good. And of course, I mentioned Bill Going. Bill Going.
Yes.
Was briefly, I guess when Baber was fired after the first year, if I remember correctly, Bill Going was in charge of the Alton Resident Center for mm-hmm. a brief time. And then he became, when the East St. Louis Center was established, then he became Dean of Instruction, it was called. Mm-hmm. And in 63, he asked me to be an assistant. He already had Bruce Thomas.
Yeah.
Where on your pen?
Yes, right.
He had Bruce Thomas in sociology and stuff. An assistant, and he had an office on this site, the Edwardsville site, by that time. And 63, he asked me to be an assistant. It wouldn't mean giving up teaching. I would be an assistant to the Dean of Instruction or something. And so I decided I would do that. I'd have a role. I had a great respect for Bill Nolan. Still do. And so I enjoyed working with him.
You know, I have written down on that as of July 1st, 1960, you were head of the Math and Science Division.
That was in 60?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I guess yes. I guess I was, although that wasn't a formal title, I don't think.
Okay. Okay.
I think it was just that I'd been here the longest by that time. And anyway, in 63, I went to the Edwardsville campus part-time. Still taught in Alton, of course.
So. Uh-huh. So did you have an office then at the Edwardsville campus in one of the tract houses?
Yeah, in one of the houses, right, in tract houses. And so that was pretty good. And so John Glenn became head of the, when Going became Dean of Instruction. I don't know how long he was head of the, Going was head of the Alton Residence Center, I think just 1 year.
Mm-hmm.
And then John Glenn from business, a professor of business, was made head of the center. And there's another story in connection with that. I'm running on like crazy.
That's all right.
But there was a faculty member, a younger faculty member, who did something. I forget what it was. He got into trouble. You know, I don't even remember the details of, why he was in trouble. But again, three of us were appointed to investigate that situation and write a report. And by John Glenn. And so we did. And it was Eric Sterling. Eric and I seem to be on all.
Yes, that's what I noticed.
And I can't remember who the third person was on that. Well, we investigated the situation and we wrote it up as accurately as we could when we thought what had gone on and turned it in. We thought we turned it in. Before we did, I guess we gave a copy to this guy we were investigating. And then we were ready to turn it in. And we got called into John Glenn's office. And he was essentially saying goodbye to us for having written such a biased report and all that sort of stuff. We didn't know what he was talking about. And it turned out that before we turned in our report, this guy who we're investigating added about twice as much again to the report and turned it in without making it clear that our report was this and his report was tacked onto it. But, you know, essentially we went in there and John Glenn was saying goodbye to us and it was nice to have known us and all that.
Here.
You know, yeah, we didn't think that report was all that, you know, much in favor of the guy, whoever he was, versus the university. And we listened, and the more we listened, the more we became confused because of what we had presumably said in this report. Finally, we said, "May we see this report?"
Yes.
And so it turned out we stayed on. It was the other guy, the guy we investigated, did not. So, working with Going as when he was Dean of Instruction. And later, I think they changed his title to Dean of Academic Affairs or something. And we, at some point, needed a third person in the office, and we interviewed a few people, and we brought Jim Brown.
Yes.
Jim Brown into, so that was, we played a role in getting Jim into administration, which went onward and upward from there.
Right.
And the rest of us pretty well got out. Anyway, then there came a time when apparently a lot of people in the state legislature and maybe even the state higher board, I don't know who all was involved with this, it was political, were going to separate the campuses. And Dwight Morris reacted immediately to reorganize SIU. And he would, it was one university, the key words were one university. And we had then academic affairs on both campuses.
Mm-hmm.
Business affairs on both campuses. And I don't know, physical plant or something on both. You know, everything was organized instead of this way, it was organized this way. And so Robert McVicker was appointed vice president for academic affairs, both campuses. And I remember, and Going could not stand.
Bill, yes.
Going could not stand Robert McVicker. I mean, he thought he was crude and et cetera, et cetera. He just did not like him. There was a personality clash. Going wasn't as a Southern gentleman.
Mm-hmm.
McVicker was, I don't know what, he was a very smart guy in Oklahoma, I guess. But they just didn't get along. So Going, you know, asked to be reassigned. And so McVicker spent 3 days of the week of the work week in Carbondale, lived in Carbondale too, and spent 2 days a week up here. And the academic affairs office consisted of Bruce Thomas, Jim Brown, and myself. We called ourselves the Three Stooges. And in fact, we gave McVicker a Christmas card, a birthday card, or something, where we had had our picture taken, the three of us, with one of us covering our eyes, the other covering the ears, and the other covering the mouth.
Yes.
The three monkeys.
See no evil. You're
yeah,
no evil.
Yeah.
Speak no evil.
So, and he thought he had a good sense of humor. He thought that was delightful. Yeah. But he was extremely efficient. Bruce and I and Jim Brown would work all week, and we'd have a stack of issues for him, a stack of papers. And when he'd come up, he'd sit down at his desk with the three of us gathered around, and he'd go through these papers and literally dispose of these issues. You know, consulting with us, but explode it. And he'd do that in, it seemed like about 20 minutes, and then he was out and around the campus.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was very good, really. The clash with Going was very much a personality thing. It wasn't because they were both, I thought great people, but mm-hmm. they just didn't get along. And so the experience with McVicker was interesting, to say the least.
And then he was gone from the SIUE situation after the next reorganization. Was
he left to become president of the University of Oregon State.
Okay.
Oregon State University.
I have that written down.
And he was president of Oregon State for, I think, 13 years, longer than anybody else had been.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was a very successful president, apparently. And so that was an experience. But he said, he agreed that the splitting the university that way was a peculiar thing. I think, he didn't really agree with it. He said, 3 days a week, I'm in charge of a residential university and with a lot of buildings and so forth, whatever it is, at Carbondale. And then 2 days a week, I shift gears completely and I'm in charge of what was then entirely a commuter campus,
mm-hmm.
in an urban setting, urban attitude at least. And so there's no connection between the two,
mm-hmm.
the two jobs. So he didn't see this as lasting. Then when the reorganization occurred, when Dwight Morris felt safe that they weren't going to take away half his institution, then we had the reorganization where John Rendleman came up here as a
first.
I don't remember
chancellor.
Whether president or chancellor. It switched every other week between president and chancellor. And I was at first a little hesitant, knowing that Rendleman was, his background was law, and he had a JD, which you can call him doctor, but it wasn't quite an academic doctorate and so on. So I didn't know how it would work out, but he worked out very well, actually. He was very good. John Rendleman wanted to, he kept this Dean's Conference going.
Mm-hmm.
So he was interacting with the academic, I thought, very, very well.
Do you remember how you felt when he became involved in the Dwight Morris house affair or with the Paul Powell? Do you remember how you felt about it?
Well, I knew that I didn't know that much about the house affair, the so-called million-dollar house.
Well, he accepted responsibility for that with the Board of Trustees. He said that he had given him bad advice.
Oh, McVicker did?
No, Rendleman.
Oh, Rendleman.
Dwight Morris said publicly that it wasn't really his decision, it was John Rendleman's decision.
Oh, okay.
And John Rendleman was loyal and said, I gave him bad advice.
That sounds like something John would do.
Uh-huh.
He may have. The house was a red herring. It was really designed to be a guest house. Now, I'd been on, by this time, some state committees, yes. and so forth, and stayed in residences, Kellogg or something.
Yes.
I forget what it was. And, various places.
University of Nebraska has
one of those. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, a number of places do. And that's what this was supposed to be, And the old presidential house of Morris's on campus, I'd been in that when I was on the General Studies Committee, just something else of interest, I guess. Morris had us to dinner at his house on the campus before mm-hmm. the million-dollar house. And the thing I remember about that was he had a squirrel. The squirrel was in the house. They'd adopted the squirrel. And the squirrel was running around, jumping from, if it were this, he'd jump from the top of that bookcase to the top of this one over here. We were all sitting there. That was a very peculiar thing.
Someone like me wonders if the squirrel used a litter box.
I don't know. We were there, and we all kind of wondered about that squirrel business. But the wife was, he was, I guess you'd say he was an environmentalist. He liked the outdoors and so on. The million-dollar house was there because he had a lot of famous people come in. He had Bucky Fuller, and he had this astronomer. He, from time to time, he had, famous guests and well-known guests. And, the million-dollar house was a red herring. I didn't really blame Morris for that. Of course, the politicians are happy to get involved.
Yes.
But I didn't think that was all that bad.
At any rate, I'm interested in leadership, and I am interested in John Rendleman's time here, and his the culture that he fostered on the campus. And
I don't know of anybody on the campus that didn't like John Rendleman. I wasn't one of his poker playing buddies, but I talked to him a lot. He made an effort to know the faculty, know everybody else. He had a flip thing with pictures of everybody on the faculty, and not just on the faculty, the janitors and everything else, So he, if he had a spare minute, he'd go through these things. So he could call everybody by name on the campus, which always helps. And in these dean's meetings, he really listened to the deans, and he made decisions that took into account the opinions of the academic people. So the fact that he was a lawyer, a JD, not a PhD or in some particular field, really worked to his advantage, I think, much to my surprise. He was very good.
In going through the boxes, I noticed that when the funding started to dry up in 74 and 75, that people tried to organize for collective bargaining.
Yeah.
On campus, yeah. And then there became a group of. Do you have any comment on that or any memory about that? The FOCB.
Yeah. So. He my desk was always full of papers and stuff, and things I hadn't finished working on and so on. I would drop by Earl's office sometimes, and his desk had nothing on it. I mean, it was absolutely pristine. He got done what he had to get done. There was no mess, no fuss. So it occurred to me there is obviously there's an us and them syndrome associated with unionization, but I don't know that anybody ever felt that. That the them was really John Rendleman. I think we were trying to, pull a chain on the state legislature and so on.
Well, that's one thing I in going through the records. I've noticed that the Rendleman expected to deal with the union, and others have tried to avoid. But he expected it. That was part of his whole administration unions. He never questioned that, of course, we have to deal with unions, including the faculty union. Your department was a center of union activity with Ron Bruno. Who was a friend of ours back in those days.
Ron. Yeah, and Tom Baldwin.
Yes, Ron and Tom Baldwin.
Tom Baldwin. They were very much involved with that. But I don't think, as far as I can remember, Rembelman was never the adversary. And they thought that it was the way to go, and it probably was, but because the legislature had to. There's another unionist story when Rendleman was president. There was the painters objected to some of the preparation being done by student, where we had the student work program, of course, and maybe you have the records on this.
No.
Student work program. And the students, the university would assign the students to come in and do the preparation, move furniture and things that didn't require great skill. And then the painters come in and paint. But the painters, some of the work unions had very different ideas about what was their job, and they didn't like the students doing what they considered their job. And so there was a strike of the painters union, and the campus was picketing. And of course, Rendleman, as president, was the opposition then, and he had to, no matter how he really felt, he had to oppose the actions of the, and he was for the student worker too. So it was kind of a difficult time for him. But I remember, I guess it was while I was dean, because they had a hearing in the court where the university was supposedly trying to squash the picketing. And John Rendleman hired, would you believe, Philip Schlafly's husband to represent the university. And he asked some of us who used student workers, like the science. I mean, we used a lot of lab assistants and so forth. And in case something came up in this trial, he asked me to be present when this court process occurred. And so I went and sat. I was never called up to do anything. But I sat and watched. And Ted Schlafly had been, a reasonably good corporate lawyer. I don't know whether he'd ever been in a courtroom before in his life, but he was representing the university, much of my amazement. And I remember the judge took fully 3.5 seconds to find in favor of the unions. it was a pathetic performance on the part of the university. And I thought about it some, but I never asked Rendleman what he was thinking of, or whether he really thought the unions should prevail or what.
That's pretty interesting, because did you know John Paul Davis?
Yes.
His
lawyer. I remember the name.
John Paul Davis, his regular lawyer on staff, was very extremely liberal about unions, and extremely
I didn't know him well.
Articulate.
I didn't know him,
So that's pretty interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, it could have been. If you'd want to throw the case, Ted Schlafly was the lawyer. You know,
that's interesting.
I had, the whole Schlafly business.
Well, now my husband, who's retired, has been listening on to this this man talk about his new book about Phyllis Schlafly.
Oh, really?
Yes. He's a conservative government professor at St. Louis University.
Oh.
And Norman says Norman's kind of pretty critical of him, but hasn't read the book, of course.
No, I should read that. I square danced once with Phyllis Schlafly, and I joked that I couldn't get her to do an Alleman left. But that isn't quite true, but it was true that she was the stiffest human being I've ever had any physical contact with. It was like, trying to move a board. That is literally true. Not my favorite person.
Well, you've really... Now, when did you retire?
Well, I retired in 1988.
Okay.
I had a heart attack in 86, 2 years before. And, I'm amazed.
You...
good shape. But I thought, I've got maybe 5 years left. I really behave myself, which I don't. I could stretch it out to 6 or 7. Uh-huh. And so I retired pretty early.
Yes.
And and also I found that as far as my annuitants is concerned, I had Navy, and I had some of my TA time at Kansas would apply somehow, and mm-hmm. I bought in these years.
Did you come back and teach as a call staff?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Uh-huh. For that's a long, what I
up,
thought.
Up until just a couple of years ago.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you knew the Nancy Belk and David Warner.
Yes. Oh, yes. Uh-huh. Knew Warner very well. We served together. You have the Ken Shaw there. The search committee that brought Ken Shaw to the campus. That was one of the most interesting. Mm-hmm. I got to know Dave Warner very well on that committee. We were on it. We were at Towson State, where Ken Shaw was provost when his twins were born, and so we go back a long ways. And I didn't know him before that committee, but that was a good committee. Very interesting committee.
Well, do you have any other stories? I put race on the list here. I didn't know if you had ever been interested in that issue as part of the development of the campus, or
I know that that a lot of people in the towns were critical of SIU because it had so many black mm-hmm. students and all that, which I mm-hmm. thought was ridiculous. I know that in my classes, my physics classes, it very seldom had any blacks. But in the general education, I did, and especially history and science
mm-hmm.
Class I did with Ed. We had quite a few blocks in there.
Mm-hmm.
my experience overall was that, well, in physics we had a lot of Asians, but the advanced physics classes. And the Asians always did very well. They were always well prepared. I felt that they knew when I was going to write something on the blackboard. I think they knew what I was going to write before I wrote it. You know, I mean, they were way ahead. So my experience in teaching in so many years is that the Asians do better than the whites, and the whites do better than the blacks. Mm-hmm. But I never felt that. Well, I felt it was a cultural thing, and I didn't see that there was any intellectual difference, any brain capability different among the races. And the one thing that really depressed me about the blacks was that the black males were apparently very subject to peer pressure, and they were acting white if they got good grades and did well. But you know they were capable of it because the black women did significantly better than the black men. And I don't think there's any difference in native brain power between the black women and the black men. But the women were superior in class. Strange thing. I still think that's... I don't know how you overcome things like that. But, the boys particularly, they apparently there's an awful lot of pressure, and they pride themselves on street smarts, which obviously is something that we don't have.
Do you still live in Granite City?
Yeah.
And why did you choose to live in Granite City? Not many faculty live there.
No, I
but
know.
But as an historian, I must say I'm really interested in it. I think it's a fantastic place. But,
yeah, Bruce Thomas lived there. And of course, I got divorced from my first wife, and the woman I eventually married had lived in Granite City, and she had a son in high school there. So, so that's also she'd been in real estate in Granite City and had the connections, and we got a house there, a pretty good deal. So. That worked out. I've been happy with Granite City. By the time I lived there, it had been cleaned up in terms of the environment, and where I live, which is on the East End, I think there's only about half a dozen times in the many years I've lived there that we had any, that I thought I could detect the odor of the steel mill and the pickling plant particularly. And so it isn't a bad place to live now. The only thing, it has too many stop signs.
What do you think about the reputation of the university? Has it changed over the years?
I think it has changed. Mm-hmm. I think that first of all, I was never thrilled with the idea of a commuter campus. I found that in those early years that we were almost entirely a commuter campus, that going to school was something they also did. Mm-hmm. That they still had such a strong interest in having a job to get a set of wheels and so forth, and they're all, if they went to school, their high school buddies went to work at a steel mill or something, and were making 10 times as much money as they could. I thought that wasn't too good, and so I was not happy with the commuter campus idea. I was happy when we built Tower Lake, although that's another interesting story. We had the campus architect at that time.
I was going to ask you about Charles Pulley and John Randall, if you
John knew. Randall, yeah. I didn't have too much relationship with Pulley, but John Randall I did, and he was a good guy, except he was very strong on architectural ethics, which meant, as far as I could tell, a big fee for the architects, and no matter who. And when we decided on the Tower Lake project, I was on a committee with quite a few of us, including Jim, what's his name, the guy in...
Jim Brown?
No. He died. He was...
Jim. The guy in business.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Metcalf.
Jim Metcalf
and all.
He sounds like a very nice guy.
He was. Yeah. He was a very nice guy. And and of course, Randall was on it, and several others. And talking about the kind of things we had thought, well, we ought to see what they have at Carbondale. So we had a visit to Carbondale. And they had this project down there. And the committee decided that that was just right. This, I forget what they called it down there, but this project was just right for our campus. And furthermore, we found out afterwards that the university owned the plans for this. Mm-hmm. So I thought, well, that's great. You know, we don't have to hire anybody. We'll just use these plans and build the Tower Lake project. And Randall had a fit. I mean, first of all, you can't take the plans that were drawn up for one place and transplant them, you know, build the same thing somewhere else. Furthermore, the architect who drew up the plans, if they were built again, he was entitled to another complete fee. And but the only way they could get that across was to hire him and have him redo the plans and get another full fee. Well, that's what happened. He'd already built this project as attractively as he could in Carbondale, and he had to change it for Edwardsville. So the only thing he could do was uglify it.
Oh.
So for a big extra fee, he uglified this Carbondale project, and that's what we have at Tower Lake. I guess it's all right.
I mean, what do you mean? Do you mean in the cutting down of amenities or in the exterior design?
Just the exterior design.
Okay.
I thought that what was built at Tower Lake was less attractive just from a superficial point of view. I don't know about the facilities. But I thought, you build something the best you can, and somebody comes along and says, you got to change it. Well, if you build it as attractively as you could, then the only way you can change it is to make it less attractive. So for a big full fee, that's what happened. I've never been too thrilled with architects. I think they build monuments. And then the science building. I'm sure you've been in the auditorium wing of the science
yes.
building. Okay. What we have there is a a beautiful glass box, okay? And then inside the box, there's a concrete cylinder, which has these two auditoria. And, you know, for a casual observer, they see the glass box and all that, and it's wonderful. But then, when I first had to teach in one of those auditoriums, it was horrible. I mean, the acoustics were bad, and the seating was bad. There was no middle aisle. There was one row, and people would come in. They'd sit in the end. Everybody else would crawl over them. And I thought it was an abomination that they could put big pictures in the Architectural Review, the glass box, and wonderful, all of these.
Yes.
The artistic design is tremendous. And,
well, you were on the planning committee. How did this design come to be? Was it part of Neil Obata's original design for the building, or was it something that
it was
came
patterned
from an outside idea?
I think it was patterned on Obata's design, but by this time it wasn't Obata.
Mm-hmm.
And it was... there were all these things about the science building design that I didn't like. And Kermit Clemens, who had been head of the science division before I was, Kermit was a mathematician. He decided that all the science units would have their secretaries in a secretarial pool. So the second floor of the office wing, for example, would have a big open space for secretarial pool.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody drew a line across it, said, well, we have something on this side of this line and something else on the other. The line was just a line, but the builders interpreted it as a wall. So we had this open space with a wall across the middle of it. And that was one of the crazy things that happened. And while I think the buildings are beautiful from the outside, I think that some of Morris's ideas weren't too good on how you actually teach. And how buildings are used properly. Yeah, that was another thing. And in Carbondale, they had built an auditorium building. I mean, I don't know whether you've seen it or not. Have you spent much time in
Not a lot of time. I've been there for a few doctoral.
Yeah. Well, there were there was a round building we built in Carbondale, which, for science lectures primarily, had a single space in the middle, which was a lecture prep area, and then it had these pie-shaped segments around the edge for uh-huh. some big, some small. When we were had the going way back to the beginning, when we had the so-called faculty planning committee, or campus mm-hmm. planning committee, which Morris had the faculty on. We went down to Carbondale and we looked at the various buildings. And we decided, the faculty decided, wow, that's what we really need, you know, the building like this. And that was another one where Morris said, no, I don't know, I don't think that's what you need. And so we didn't get that.
Mm.
We got a communications building, and which we then put music in, and that was terrible for music. I mean, the man, Dale Fierstead, who was the choral director, I mean, his there was no air in that, in the building where he rehearsed. I'm sorry, the Fierstead was band director.
Yes.
Okay, band director. And everybody got headaches, and his hearing, I think he suffered some hearing loss. That building was, it wasn't designed as a music mm-hmm. building. So, you know, I, if you ask me what profession I'm least thrilled with, it's architecture.
Okay.
I don't think they, I think they're much more concerned with the art and the general appearance of something than they are with what happens to the people who have to use the building. At least that's been my experience. But they're beautiful buildings.
Yes. let's see. I was going to ask you if you knew Virgil Seymour.
Yes, I did.
Yeah, because he was very important in Clarence Stevenson's office.
Right. He
and
was.
Were you around?
Yes, I was. There were these two buildings right across the road from each other, and Going and his staff were in one, and Clarence Stevens was in the other, so-called vice president's office, and Virgil Seymour was an extremely efficient person. He, you know, he knew what he was doing, and was, I'm sure. He was like a chief of staff to Clarence Stevens.
Yes, he was.
Yeah. And he helped enormously. And it was a real shock when he, what mm-hmm. he had was a heart bypass, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And we couldn't believe it. You know, he was doing well after the bypass, and then something broke.
Right.
Died. Uh-huh. Yeah, right. That was a tragedy.
Yeah. I think so. And then what about, did you know Peter Simpson at all?
Not very much.
Okay.
How about
what about Hyman Frankel? He didn't stay here. But what's...
He was, a lot of people thought he was an illusion or maybe a hallucination. I don't know, because he was always on the faculty, but he was never here. He was a very talented guy and so, you know, he was one of the first persons. Well, we all knew each other very well in those days. And I was great.
Mm-hmm.
He had very appropriate, I thought. Mm-hmm. Some people would say he was liberal. Mm-hmm. He was. As a sociologist, and I thought he was great. But I wonder if he's still alive. I don't know.
I'd wonder too. I don't know either.
Yeah.
I think he might be someone.
He would come, you know, he'd be on some government commission, and he'd be away for, he'd be on leave. And then he'd maybe come back for a term, quarter system, and then he'd be gone again on another commission. So there were people, even on his own faculty, that said, you know, does he really exist? Or is he just on the roster here? But he was very good when he was here. But he had too many irons in the fire to stay here.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing.
Well, do you have anything... any conclusion to say about the university that you thought I might ask that I haven't asked or
I think the Dwight Morris picture, Dwight was a terrible autocrat, there's no doubt about that. I mean, he could be aggravating, but he had some very good ideas as well as some not so good. And I think wanting to build a university in other than the traditional mold liberal arts. I still think that's an abomination. I think that's, from a managerial standpoint, a unit like the College of Liberal Arts mm-hmm. doesn't make any sense. It's just the way universities develop historically. Mm-hmm. And I think Dwight was right in trying to get rid of that for this campus. There's something else I can say about that.
I'd ask.
I can't remember what it was I was going to
say. Okay. Well, when maybe after I type this up and you're looking it over, you might think of some.
Okay.